This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. At the bottom of the hour, my guest is going to be Eugenia Lovett. West, who is 96 years old, and she has written the third in her wonderful mystery series, and I'm looking forward to talking to her. But now, right here in the studio, I have our own legal eagle, Bill Larson of Larson & Larson. I'm so happy to have you here, Bill.
Good morning.
Okay, good morning. Well, my goodness, I was at BoucherCon this weekend. I did hear some horror stories. I think that authors who have gone through legal problems, sometimes they start shaking when they talk about them, as I still do, and that's many, many years later. So what do you have for us today?
We had some questions asked by some of the listeners, mm-hmm. and one of them was concerning this law called the CASE Act.
Yeah, what is that?
Okay, so this is a new law that's going to create a special tribunal within the Copyright Office to resolve copyright disputes for folks that don't have a lot of money and can't afford, you know, fancy lawyer to go into federal court. Uh-huh. The jurisdiction will be limited. It's consensual, but it will give a venue for folks who don't want to spend a lot of money on expensive lawyers in federal court to resolve copyright disputes. And so it's, in a sense, an administrative tribunal. These tribunals already exist inside the copyright, in the trademark office and the patent office, so it's nothing new, okay? And it'll give the opportunity of folks with less financial means to put a dispute in front of the tribunal and get a resolution that would be, could be approved by a court, and they could get a limited amount of damages, only about $30,000. So it's not your million-dollar cases. But more importantly, what they would be looking for is injunctions to stop the infringement.
Okay.
And it's pending in the Senate right now. It's not been approved.
It hasn't been approved, but that sounds like a good law.
There's pros and cons. Okay?
Yeah.
So there's people on both sides. The pros obviously say this is a great venue for folks that don't have a lot of money. But there's also a lot of folks who say, well, this is just going to be not much of anything because no defendants would consent to this type of jurisdiction. And they're concerned about a very small tribunal making decisions for people mm-hmm. Without the aid of, let's say, the bigger court system.
Yeah, it's a problem because certainly if you're going up against the big publishers,
They're not going to consent. They're going to use their money to bury you. So you're not going to. This would just be for
smaller
company. And I can see people, some smaller companies doing it that way. Like, so, for instance, let's say you're accused of copyright infringement. You don't believe you infringe, but the defendant doesn't have the money to hire an expensive law team. Then they can handle it themselves and argue it themselves before the tribunal and get an inexpensive result.
Uh-huh. No, and it might help because there are cases, and one of the cases that somebody mentioned to me is that it's two indie authors. I mean, they both self-published on Amazon, mm-hmm. and one is accusing the other of essentially taking her work, something like that would fall under this?
If they consented to it, yes.
If they consented
to
it.
So both parties have to consent, all right?
And because they are fighting right now, and sort of it's getting to the point where they're like insulting each other publicly. So it would be a good idea to resolve the situation.
Right. So depending on the amount of money involved, the person with more money is always going to take litigation and just try to bury the other side. Most cases are won and lost by the financial ability of the litigants mm-hmm. rather than a jury finding. Intellectual property cases settle. 99 out of 100 settle, okay, or go away because usually one or the other either gets tired, exhausted or financially destroyed and finally gives up or gives in the case.
Or drops
case,
dead
right?
after.
Or it's fixed during mediation, okay? And so I've noticed in my practice and over all the years in litigating cases, and in about 18 months, even people who are very good litigators start to get tired of it. It's just, it wears you down.
Uh-huh.
And so for that reason, a lot of cases go away. I think the fear of the fast process inside the copyright office will be, A, you don't have a jury, right? So you have this administrative tribunal, kind of similar to arbitration. There would be specialists. They would be copyright specialists, so they wouldn't be just, you know, any old folks. They would know their copyright law, which is very complex. But everybody's always a little scared about taking the choice away from a jury of your peers.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's no access to a lot of authors, artists, and other copyright owners because the federal court system is overly expensive.
Yes, it is. And you do get very tired of it.
It's exhausting for the litigants, and it's exhausting for the lawyers. So I'm very settlement-oriented. I try very hard to settle cases, but you can't always do that. Some people are not going to give in ever. But we try to settle them as much as we can. In all court systems, there's a requirement for mediation, which is a process to try to settle your claims without resolution by the judge or jury. It's very effective. But really, what settles cases is just tiredness. You just get worn out and you just say, okay. Or whatever you were mad about the infringement before doesn't seem as important anymore after about 18 months and then kind of withers and dies on the vine.
That windshield wiper lawsuit that somebody...
That poor guy fought for 20 years.
Yeah. 20
drove him crazy, ruined his life.
Yeah.
And it's a great movie.
I mean, that was like...
That was a patent case.
Yeah, that was a patent case.
And they outright stole his invention.
Yeah.
And he eventually won.
Uh-huh.
And did it himself, pro se, but it drove him to madness.
Yeah.
So sometimes you got to wonder, you know, whether it's worth it.
Well,
I tell that to my clients, you know, is it really worth it? I mean, and everybody's really angry in the beginning, but that anger kind of goes away. And I'll tell my listeners here, and I tell all my clients, I can settle more cases with an I'm sorry than I can with $1 million. It's really more personal for people than it is financial in many of this.
It is. And, you know, For authors, you take such pride in your work. If it's your work and you know you did it, it's really hard when somebody comes along and says, oh, that was my idea, and it wasn't their idea, and you know it wasn't their idea. It's like, it just makes you absolutely crazy.
Right, so we have counterfeiting and trademark cases all the time, and really angers. I'm representing a lot of clients right now that are being counterfeited, and most of the stuff pops up on websites and stuff, and then we knock it down. And people who invent great things only to have those stolen by others who are very effective at making them quickly and more cheaply and selling them for less. And so people are rightly upset when they work very hard to create something and then it's taken from them.
Yeah.
No compensation.
Oh.
It's tough.
And in the case of the case law,
mm-hmm.
one would have to go to Washington, D.C. There would be a tribunal there.
Yeah, there'd be a tribunal there. With these administrative tribunals, it's typically all digital, so you just...
Oh, so you can do it online.
You do it yourself, and then you kind of upload your arguments and your evidence.
Oh, so you don't even have to go...
So there's still an issue of when the law finally comes out, what will be the evidentiary standards and what kind of discovery can be taken, what kind of evidence and how you would introduce evidence. We have the same process in patent and trademark cases, where we upload it all. It's all electronic. You never see anybody. It's all digital.
Which gets us back to keeping a good record of your work.
Evidence is wins cases. So if it's not in writing, it doesn't exist. So if you keep even your own notes or, you know, emails, you know, confirming conversations and so forth and dating and your work, then you're going to have evidence that's going to convince the judge. But if you don't have that evidence, then even though you're right, you may not prevail.
And you actually should have an inventory. Just,
mm-hmm.
I mean,
Absolutely. We
talk about intellectual property. Now, if you own a bunch of buildings, you are going to have an inventory of the buildings. You're going to have an inventory of what's in the buildings. You're going to have written and... It always surprises me when I talk to writers, and they'll say, well, I wrote this article 20 years ago, and then it was really good, and my publisher at the time said, I really like that. That should be a book. And then I didn't think about it until 10 years later. So I wrote a book based on this first article. And so they've done things. They put things out there in different venues, whether it's blogs or whether it's, because nowadays so many people put so much on blogs. People will even put their whole story idea, I've seen it, on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I'm going to write a book, and this is my character. And I'm like, what are you doing? There should be a physical inventory, mm-hmm. like a spreadsheet or a document, right?
Right, exactly.
Because you also need it for your, estate planning.
Yes. Right. If you don't keep a written inventory of your work and what you're doing, then and if you do pass away, or no one will ever know what was there.
Exactly what mm-hmm. you did or where. And also, like, if, for example, you write a book based on a story that you sold to a magazine, like this person had done a major magazine, a Harper's or one of those big magazines, a story, nice mm-hmm. story, based on some family business, and then 10 years later decided to turn it into a book. Now, it brings a point, would the original story 10 years ago, which was based on the family, it was a family farm and the business and stuff. It was a cute story, okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they, 10 years later, they decide to write a book.
Right.
Now, the copyright for the story, if it was, it was a big magazine. Mm-hmm. The magazine has that copyright for that story, or the author has that copyright?
Well, the copyright exists in the first place with the author, whoever okay. put the pencil to paper. And then that copyright can be transferred through sale or assignment. That's true.
So, and this person didn't say this was a problem because maybe the magazine didn't know he wrote the book. But so the life of the copyright is 70 years.
Yeah, I think of keep 100 years
keep 100 years.
100 years in your head is a
100 years. So
safe number.
So. Would it be 100 years from the first story or 100 years from the book story?
Right. So the law differs in terms of whether you're corporations or you're individuals or whether the work was published or not published, or was it secret? And the law is very complex in that, and it's very fact sensitive how long it's going to last. Sometimes people will write a book and they'll stick it away and not show it to anybody for 50 years, and then the question becomes, well, does that copyright go for 100 years after first publication or when you first wrote it? And the law is very complex in that area.
Well, for example, Charlotte Bronte, her very first book is called The Professor. It was never published in her lifetime. It was published after she died. Her husband did a foreword and got it published. And mm-hmm. it is a brilliant book. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think it's her very, very best book. I think it's better than anything else she ever wrote. But it was published after she died. Mm-hmm.
So the heirs get the copyright.
Yeah.
And then there's a period of time after death where the copyright exists. Uh-huh. And the heirs can continue to reap the benefits.
Yeah, and I would, and something like that, this is an example of, although it's not a well-known story, I think it's brilliant. And it would make like the perfect movie. It would make a perfect movie. So this could happen to any author.
Yes.
You write something today.
You sit on it.
You might publish it. You might self-publish it. You might keep it in your drawer, as you say. And then your family comes along and says, "Gee, Daddy wrote this really wonderful book."
This happens a lot with musicians. They do an enormous amount of work, and they record their work, and then they pass away, right? Prince is a fine example. They've gone into his vault and they said there's an enormous amount of music in there that's never been released, which they're working on releasing. And so, that'll, when this becomes into the public, then it'll start to, the clock will start to tick, I would guess, for his estate to release all of that music.
Now, if you're involved with somebody doing copyrights and all of this, trademarks and all this, you keep on top of it for them too. I mean,
we calendar everything.
Yeah,
Yes. Yeah, we have a complex calendaring system, so we keep track of everything. So we routinely create portfolios for our clients. Some of them have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of either patents, trademarks, copyrights, and we keep track of that for them.
And for many authors, they might write a novel, but they have a vast, you know, library of works that they've done, whether mm-hmm. they're nonfiction or they're in stories and blogs. Where do blogs come into this?
Blogs is just the new way of people just posting their different thoughts and ideas about different things. And a lot of times they're questions and answers, and other times they're just statements of uh-huh. stuff. I use blogs because I find some of the people that in the blog sphere are pretty smart.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they think of things that I would never think of. I use them often sometimes when I'm analyzing the law to get a different point of view. And there's some very smart people out there putting a point of view out that you just would never have thought of before. You say, hey, maybe you're right. You got something there.
Yeah.
So blogs can be very, very helpful. They're very helpful for me. I use them.
And, of course, people blog, and oftentimes nowadays they take the blogs and turn them into books.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, but the copyrights belong to the blogger.
Yeah, that's a complex question there.
Yes.
Well, it's a strong maybe. Yeah, it would depend on the blog itself. That would be very complex to
yeah.
figure that one out.
So if the blogger puts up a bunch of, which would be better, to write the book and have 12 blogging ideas, publish the book first and then put
blog afterwards.
And blog afterwards,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah, well, you always want to get your copyright first. Right, then you're safe. So with trademarks, patents, and copyrights, it's always the safest is to file as early as possible, get your application in, get it registered. And then you can do anything you want,
yeah.
because once the government approves it, then there's nothing you can do really to destroy it.
Well, this is sort of what I'm doing myself, because I'm writing a book now about how to help writers really market their books. And at one point I thought, well, I'll just blog it. I'll put it on my... And then I realized, well, no.
Are you giving it away?
Yeah. Am I giving it away? So now I'm doing like 12 chapters, and then once it's... I can then always put one chapter at a time
mm-hmm.
on my website. But I've done the book first,
yeah.
which I think is a much more sensible thing to do.
Yes.
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 Okay. See, the lawyer here, our legal eagle says, do it first. Write the book. Get the copyright.
Get the copyright filed.
Okay. Now, what's the other question? We had
Was it Quibi?
Yeah, Quibi. I had not heard of that before.
Okay, it's a new streaming app that's going to come out next year. It's very well funded, has some very big players, and it's going to be competing with all the other well-known streaming apps. But they're going to have like short 10-minute videos that you can watch and contribute to them. So it'll be interesting to see how it rolls out and if people will accept the format.
And apparently one of the listeners has some idea of, I didn't quite understand what these little videos were going to be about.
They could be about anything.
About anything, right?
Right.
And so this person, our listener here, wants to submit a bunch of them
mm-hmm.
To Quibi.
Right.
Should they,
well,
is the copyright, I mean, if they just, how does that work? I mean, they're not published ideas. They're just ideas they're sending into this company. What's the rights?
So they haven't started yet, so we haven't
yeah.
seen what the contracts are going to look like, but there's going to be some kind of sharing of the work and the revenues. But that's yet to be seen.
And, okay, I've been involved. Anybody who has ever been involved with anything in Hollywood.
The format is what's going to be the most interesting, is whether people are going to be drawn to these 10-minute quick videos.
Yeah, that idea, and also the idea that, I'm sorry, it makes me laugh now. It's been enough years. I'm distanced from it. I'm on the west coast of Florida instead of the west coast. I can laugh about this. But they do not hesitate in Hollywood. You can have the entire script done and copyrighted, and it's registered all over the place. And they will just take that script and they will run with it and they'll change the name. I mean, literally change the name. I mean, like, at least retype the thing. Do so.
Well, the whole streaming format has changed the world and the platform. And a lot of the folks who own the content are on a march right now to put folks out of business who are obtaining the content from overseas or other sources, and then signing up customers and then streaming other people's content. And there's a lot of big lawsuits out right now going on to try to stop people from misusing content through streaming apps.
Well, I would strongly suggest anybody, if you have an idea, before you go sending it out, especially to Hollywood, see Bill Larson of Larson & Larson and make sure that somebody in the world knows that it was your idea, because then Bill can go after them, maybe. Because you send a great idea, a really great idea. I mean, a brilliant idea, something really unusual and something that'll grab them. And then they'll steal it. They'll say their grandmother in the old age home over there, as she's looking out over at the ocean, she came up with this idea. But if you told Bill Larson first, and he has a copy, and he's put it in his book and portfolio that he's going to keep for all writers, you have some protection, right?
Yes, and copyright you don't have to have a lawyer do a copyright for you. They're very easy to do. You know, you can just go on the Copyright Office website and fill out the form and upload your work and pay your $30 fee or whatever it is, and it's not hard to do. So authors should take advantage of that, because the Copyright Office has specifically set the system up so that it can be performed, filed, and achieved without the use of a lawyer. And they have papers called circulars that they release that walk you through how to do it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I tell a lot of my clients, come on in, let me show you how to do it, rather than paying me a fortune to do it each time. Come on in, I'll show you how to do it, and then you can do the rest
yourself. Hear that, everybody? You can go to Larson & Larson. They're right here in St. Petersburg, and Bill will help you and walk you through how to do the copyright properly, not put it in an envelope and send it registered. Please don't do that. Don't do that kind of thing. Because it is important. Now, for example, if this person wants to do Quibi and they have the idea for a half dozen ideas, would they have to copyright each one, or can they just do one document saying, these are my Quibi ideas?
Right, they have to go individually. There's no more shotgunning of the copyrights anymore now. They used to allow you to do that, but they changed that. So each one of those segments is theoretically needed to be copyrighted. So you need to be able to do it yourself. And I mean, it's $35 or $40 bucks for the file fee, and then you're paying a lawyer $500 for each one. You're going to spend a lot of money.
Yeah.
Now, if you're a big company and then you got a lot of money, it's not an issue. But for other folks that are trying to break in, you need to do it. Figure out how to do it yourself.
Okay. How about? I don't know if this is legal. I can ask Bill. How about if you have six ideas? Mm-hmm. You write a story about a character, a guy named Joe Schmo, who's one morning wakes up and he just had a lot of six dreams in a row, and he writes them all down. Then that's one document. You don't have to copyright it once.
If it's the same, right? If it's a
okay, this is
whether it's two different concepts.
Yeah. Okay.
But
well,
the Copyright Office will look at it, and if they think that it's more than one, sometimes they'll ask you to break it up.
Okay, well, Bill, you've given us a lot of good advice today. Tell us, how can people get a hold of you?
They can find me on the web at larsonpatentlaw.com here in beautiful Clearwater, Florida.
Oh, absolutely.
Gorgeous out today.
Oh, it's so beautiful here. People, I was in Dallas. It was 45 degrees. It was horribly windy, too. And it's so beautiful here, isn't it?
Great fishing, too.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Perfect place for writers to write and readers to just stop dreaming about writing and actually write that book. Right?
Sit on the beach and stare at the Gulf of Mexico and write your book.
That's right. One day, Bill is going to write a book, right?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming in today. Bill Larson of Larson & Larson, you all need a lawyer because your intellectual property is valuable. Okay?
Okay.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye. Okay, we'll have a few commercials and then I'll be right back.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my very special guest today. Eugenia Lovett West has written the third in her wonderful series of Emma Street Mysteries, and the new book is called Firewall. I am so, so very happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Eugenia Lovett West. Hi, Eugenia.
Oh, hi. Oh, what a pleasure to be back with you again, Patsy.
Oh, this is so wonderful. I love, well, you know, you've been on twice now, and the second time was, I tell you, by popular demand. I got so many wonderful emails about you and how you are an inspiration, and just that your books are so very good. And the new book, Firewall, I'm telling you, this is one of those you can't put it down. You just can't put it down. It's just, I love this character, Emma Street, a former opera singer, and she's gone through a lot in these three books.
Oh, she gets into big trouble. Emma does. And you know, I know her by now better than I know my own children, and it's my job to get her through these terrible situations that she gets herself into and out of them again.
Well, we started off, you know, with her first husband. Her husband was murdered. Her house was destroyed. And in the new book, I really like her godmother.
Caroline is a character.
She is a character and wonderfully developed. And throughout, I mean, you have created such believable characters. As you said, you believe in them. I believe in them. And they are people that we would like to know. And, of course, the wonderful thing about your books is you have, first of all, you know, this book is about cyber terrorism. And it's an up-to-date kind of book, and so it's just from that point of view, it shows that, you know, women writers can handle a subject like cyber terrorism, and that women of any age can understand cyber terrorism. So it's very relevant. And then, of course, what I love about your books is that you take us to different countries.
Oh, yeah. I know. I do, too, Patsy. That's half the fun. It's going back to places that I traveled with my business husband, like Paris and London and Rome, and going back and sort of reliving them again, revisiting. That's so much fun.
Oh, it is. I tell you, you have a great sense of place. You really can take us to a location, put us there, and make us feel, you know, give us just the right feel so that we are there. And as in this case, there you have Florence, really all the cities that I love and that I went to. And for readers who haven't been there yet, I think it's inspiring. You say, oh, wow, that sounds interesting. I'd like to go, you know?
Yeah, go there, enjoy, learn. It's very important to us to all broaden our horizons as much as we can.
Well, it's funny. I was just talking to my mailman went to Scotland, and it was the first time he had really done a major trip. And why he picked Scotland, he wasn't even sure. But he said, you know, I just suddenly got the urge. I needed to see something different. And so he went to Scotland. And, of course, you have Scotland in the book. And it just is so good to go to places and to see different people. And then when you're reading books, you really have this wonderful, as you said, reliving. You relive that excitement of when you went to a place.
Absolutely.
So... Well, tell us about the idea. How did you get this idea for Firewall? Because, as I said, it's a very modern idea, very up to date idea. And Emma Street is comes from a different background. She's a former opera singer and so an artist. So tell us about how you got involved in cybercrime.
In cybercrime, well, it's really, you know, I'm far from being, you know, expert at cybercrime, but it just kept dawning on me how important it is in our lives, how we are all affected by it and vulnerable to it. And so that was really how I got started. You know, what can frighten Emma or threaten her? And I thought, whoa, maybe cybercrime. So Emma becomes a victim of cybercrime and nearly, of course, loses her life, but in the end, brings a villain to justice. But the whole thing is so much in our daily lives that that's really what inspired me to go into cybercrime rather than something else.
Well, this...
It's out there and it's sort of there and you can't put your finger on it. It's not like the old-fashioned... ways that detectives could put their villain in handcuffs and take them to court. It's a whole new dimension.
And it is frightening, and that's why I think this the way you've written it, it takes it beyond a mystery. Really, it's a thriller. This is like any of the great thrillers written by Baldacci and Brad Meltzer and all of those authors, because it's not just a simple little mystery. It's a thriller.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to thrilled to have you say that.
Well, I think, you know, people will, as I said, they'll start reading and they'll say, yes, you know, this is something they want to know about. Even, you know, the nice thing is you're not too technical, but you know enough about it, and you've obviously done enough research that it sort of makes us focus on what could happen, how people can take over a money manager can take your money out of your account, or there's the cybercrime where they take your identity, and so it has this relevancy that makes the novel so fascinating.
Or follow you. I think that was what was frightening me and through me to Emma was being followed wherever she went and not knowing it.
And it does.
And which can happen.
It does.
Which can happen.
And the way that nowadays they follow you on the internet, follow you everything you do, they know everything you do, it starts to creep you out.
Yeah, creepy is the right word.
And, tell us about Emma, because I think you come out with a really wonderful character.
Emma. You know, I'm so close to her now that it's hard to she's trying to move forward with her life. You know, she's come to an impasse. She has really no man in her life, but she would like to have permanence and make a new home for her boy. She's stuck. She's a little bit stuck. But she's also because she has this talent, unlikely talent, for making unlikely connections, that she's the go-to person for people in her family or friends who are in trouble. So that's really how she gets into trouble. She's answering calls for help. I mean, she's got a big heart, and she's a little too impetuous. She has a pretty sharp temper. She's messy with her clothes, but she's smart, and she's, as I say, she has a very big heart, and her troubles are basically brought on because she's trying to help other people.
And she has a former lover.
Quite interesting
character, that one.
Oh, yeah. Lord Andrew Rodale. I know. We can't make him permanent because that would take away sort of the fun of it. But, man, is their relationship an up-and-down roller coaster. So that keeps going.
Yeah, it does, and it's wonderful. I love that character because, we all want someone like that, a former lover like that. That's a nice idea.
I mean, he's a dynamic man, very. He's a challenge.
Well, I think you must have fun writing the scenes.
Oh,
with him.
I do. I have a lot of fun with him.
You know, it's just so wonderful what you've done. As I said, you were on before for Sarah's War, which is a completely different story, a story of the Revolutionary War, which I found so fascinating. And then your ability to write now, you know, the mysteries and or a thriller, as I like to think of this one, isn't it exciting to be able to do this?
It's exciting. It's a little bit, Patsy, it's a little bit risky because I think perhaps the most successful authors have stuck to one genre. You know, they have their following. And I think one of the problems of being almost 97 is that I the younger writers develop their big followings, and doing two genres perhaps doesn't help that. But doing the history is so rewarding, to go back particularly to the American Revolution. Doing the research is fascinating, and I've just come to realize doing that how much we owe these founding fathers. We live in challenging times, but they laid down some foundations that can be applied to our situations. And so it's very different style of writing those two genres, because with the history you have to do the facts, and then if it's a novel, apply the imagination. Whereas the mysteries, you have a set of rules. You have, you know, you have to throw in red herrings here and there. You have to give the reader some clues, not have the villain appear on the last page, which was what I did with the first one and had to do an awful lot of revising. But it takes a very different mindset to do the two different genres, if you see what I'm
absolutely. And it takes a great mind to write anything, but you are so extraordinary. When's your birthday?
My birthday is February. I'll be 97 in February.
What's the date? You're not a Valentine baby, are you?
No, I'm not. I'm 20th.
February 20th. Well, you know what I'd like to have you back on then so that we can
oh I love to come back.
We'll celebrate.
I would love to do that. I would love to do that.
Because, you know, I wasn't even going to mention your age because, you know, sometimes it's like when an author has a famous a famous husband or a famous wife, and then they come on and they always talk about the famous person, you know, in their life. Mm-hmm. Or I don't want to get bogged down with talking about your age too much because, I mean, no, you write like, this is as fresh as any 25-year-old would write. And so, but, it is, of course, a wonderful thing that at your age that you are doing this. You know, you started... Tell us about when you entered a contest, which you didn't win when you started writing. Is it true that you entered a contest?
Yeah, I did. I did. I started out as a journalist when my youngest child was in school all day. I mean, I had another life besides writing. I was married to a businessman who was making his way up the ladder, and I had four children, and one was pretty much an afterthought, but she's a treasure. And when she was in school all day, I started to rush around with a Nikon camera, you know, doing interviews and whatnot. But that sort of turned to writing, you know, 300 words. Hey, I can do 300 pages. And the first novel was absolute trash. It was a dreadful wastebasket material. And then I wrote The Ancestors Cry Out, which was historical. Then I wrote a mystery for Friends, and I sent it to a Malice Domestic contest put on by St. Martin's Press, and they picked it up. You know, I didn't win the contest, but it caught the attention of a judge, and she sent it on to an editor at St. Martin's Press, and Patsy, I was just sitting, forgot all about it, sitting at the computer one morning, opened it up, and here was this email saying, we like your book, we would like to give you a contract for two books, you know, and for a beginning writer, unknown, it literally doesn't get better than that. That is huge. So that's the story about how I got into although I had been published by Doubleday,
but this was
huge.
It is, and I do always tell writers that they should enter these contests, and you never know, and you don't have to be the winner because it's happened to quite a few authors where in these good contests, the people who read the work are. Mm-hmm. People in the business. People have to be careful not to just enter any old contests that they get, you know, through the email. But for legitimate contests, they have really talented people reading the submissions, their agents or their editors or their people in the book business who know good writing. And they can spot it. And so, you know, you're discovered. It's sort of like Lana Turner sitting, you know, it's a wonderful, sometimes it's just miraculous how things happen.
Oh, I know. I mean, just the luck of the draw in some ways, but it was exciting moment. I, you know, practically levitated out of my chair up to the ceiling. Oh my God, what happened? So that was that, and so that started off the Emmas. That started the Emmas.
Well, I think you've done a beautiful job with the new book. It is a thriller. It's called Firewall, and I also want to mention your website because you have a very nice website. And it's got lots of information there about you. Wow. When I think about you and I think of you getting married in 1944 and remembering it.
Yeah. I know. I've seen a lot of interesting things, you know, happened during then, and lots of changes, but I think our generation coming along is a very exciting one. I love being with my grandchildren, and I have a great grandchild now too. But Patsy, you know, I'm probably one of the luckiest people on the planet. I mean, I'm able to create. I have, you know, maintenance of the old chassis takes quite a while, but hey, I'm so lucky to be able to do this.
And married 60 years to a pilot, because you know, my husband's also a pilot, so I know they are such special people. Anyone who's been a pilot, the you know, dashing, and so it's yeah. Isn't it wonderful? And it's that you had 60 wonderful years. I'm really thrilled to know you and to get to read your books. And as I said, we'll have you back on for your birthday, and we'll have a celebration.
Oh, what fun! What fun!
You know, and are you working on a fourth book now?
I'm thinking about it. I'll get, you know, Sarah's sort of launched, but have to get Emma a little bit launched into the world, and then. And then have to think about a new baby. what's it going to be? Well, but definitely, especially in January when the days are long and you don't get out as much. That's the time that it's really fun to be working on a new adventure.
Well, your life has been an adventure, and you really, I think, you're an inspiration. The website is EugeniaLovettWest.com. People can go there. They can see little snippets about your life, about your books. And Emma Street is back, and it's called Firewall, and the book is available wherever books are sold. And just everybody enjoy this book. It's fascinating, and it's something that we really all have to think about.
Well, Patsy, thank you so much. Thank you so much for this opportunity to talk with you.
Well, I love you. I think you're just great, and I will make sure that I talk about you also to all of the writing groups that I go to. I'm booked up for quite a few, and I want to make sure that I tell people that it's never too late. You can do it if you want to.
That's the motto, never too late.
That's right.
Never too late.
Never too late. Get out there and just do it. And you are a great example for everybody. So, again, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today, Eugenia. And we'll talk to you in February.
Well, again, thank you so much, Patsy.
Okay.
Enjoy.
And have a wonderful holiday season, okay?
You too. Okay. You too.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Wow. Isn't she fantastic? Ha-ha. Ha-ha. What are you going to be doing when you're 97 years old? Think about that. What are you going to be doing? You could be an author. You could be attending events like BoucherCon. I did meet, I met an 80-year-old woman. I met two 80-year-old people, an 80-year-old man, an 80-year-old woman, and they both are writing mysteries. And I'm going to have one or both of them on over the next few months. I've got so many people that I met there that will be on the program. And everything from an FBI agent, a couple of wonderful, very, very fascinating people involved in the espionage world, and Navy SEALs, and all sorts of wonderful people, and some very inspirational nonfiction authors. So I had a really great time at BoucherCon. And if you are, you know, it's November, this is National Novel Writing Month, and you still have time. You're a little bit late, but you could write a novel. You could write at least, you know, 25,000 pages. Just set something for yourself. It's NaNoWriMo time. It's up to you. Think about 97 years old. How much fun you could have going on a book tour. My goodness. What are most people doing at that age? Nothing. But you could do it. You could be on a book tour and signing autographs. And it's really exciting. I was so thrilled when I met so many of the authors there. And It was funny. I couldn't take too many books back with me. So I said every to them, I said, look, if you want to be on the program, you have to autograph the book and send it to me because I can't schlep all of these books. But it is wonderful. And they get so thrilled when they are signing autographs and it could happen to you. It's all up to you. Remember, this is what I've told you over and over, a page a day. In a year, you'll have 365 pages, which is actually the perfect size for a novel. I got several novels that were, it was very clever, 699 pages. They didn't want to go over 700. So 699 pages. It was one of 699 and one of 696 pages. They're big novels. But, you know, it's up to you how many pages you want, how many years you want to work on one book. I don't know how long it took to write 697, 98, 99 pages, but you can do it. Because remember, what I always tell you, and this is absolutely true, one of the joys of life, really, is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. And I want to, next week I'm going to talk about audible books for you and about how you can protect yourself. You do not just want to hire anyone to record your audible book. Bill Larson also has some information on that. If you are going to hire somebody to do your audible book, make sure that you have a contract that does not give them any rights to anything. And if you're going to have a royalty agreement, make sure that you go run it through a lawyer. Don't do it yourself, and don't let the audible person, the narrator, give you a contract that is their usual contract. That you don't want to take somebody's usual contract, because usually that means it's in their favor. And I want to really warn you, I did hear a few sad stories of people who hired companies, or they thought they were hiring companies, but actually individual people, to do their audible books, and they've actually signed over rights for royalties for the rest of their lives to people that they thought they were hiring as contractors. So there's different ways to do audible books, but you have to be really careful about handing over your rights, and don't sign somebody else's contract. The only contract you sign is a contract that your lawyer, like Bill Larson of Larson & Larson, has prepared for you, because it's your intellectual property and you have to protect yourself. So again, remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very lucky, hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a streaming video, a major motion picture, or a series on, Lifetime or Hallmark Channel. You never know. Anyway, it's up to you. Be careful out there and say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed. Thank you for everything. I'm going to be here next week. We're going to have an absolute wonderful program, and some really exciting guests are coming over the next few months. And my mind is just overwhelmed with all of the great people that I met at BoucherCon. Okay, bye-bye now, everybody. Have an absolutely wonderful weekend here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Bye-bye now.